It's just a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Kate, for that lovely introduction. The Institute for Marriage and Family Canada, it already feels like you've been around for a long time. I don't know. I'm getting used to this. It's a delightful, terrific group of people doing really important things for Canada that have implications beyond your borders as well. So I'm really glad you're here today, and I hope that you'll continue to stay involved and to bring colleagues to their future functions. I wanted to talk with you about a matter that's very close to my heart, of great interest to me, and something that I've been working on for quite some time. It actually grew out of my interest in the experience of children of divorce, which I have done a study of, written a book about. And my question and concern about how children make sense of their lives and their identities and themselves and their values and their beliefs, how children make sense of the big questions in life, the big moral and spiritual questions in life when their parents are divorced. That question has led me into other questions about children who, for whatever reason, are not growing up in a home with their mother and father. And it led me to many of the articles that I and developments that I report to you in this new report called The Revolution in Parenthood, The Emerging Global Clash Between Adult Rights and Children's Needs, which is available in your packet. It's also available on the website of Institute for Marriage and Family Canada. You can read the whole report there, so if you want to share it with a friend, you can find it there. This is the thesis on the table. Around the world, the two-person mother-father model of parenthood and marriage is increasingly being fundamentally challenged. The growing emphasis today is on adult rights to children rather than children's needs, whenever possible, to know and be raised by their mother and father. There are multiple trends driving what I call this revolution in parenthood. These trends include some that are very familiar to us, high rates of divorce and single-parent childbearing, and others that are not as familiar, including the growing use of sperm and egg donors and surrogates in reproduction, support for same-sex marriage and increasing visibility of same-sex parenting, and increasing interest in group marriage arrangements or legal recognition of some kind for group unions. These changes are proceeding at breakneck speed around the world as reproductive technologies advance, as science continues pushing the boundaries on baby making, and as new constituencies are more openly having and raising children and advocating for legal and public recognition. Quite often around the world, the state is actively supporting and at times leading the way in this revolution in parenthood. In law and in culture, the new idea is this: that children are fine with any one or more adults being called their parents so long as those adults are nice people. But how do children feel about the brave new world of parenthood? Do fathers and mothers matter to children? Does how children feel matter? Among the changes that are breaking open the two-parent mother-father model of parenthood, in your own country, in this country, in Canada, as most of you here know, the law that recently legalized same-sex marriage nationally also quietly erased the term natural parent across the board in federal law, replacing it with the term legal parent. With that little notice change, the focus of the law shifted dramatically for all children in Canada, not just those raised by same-sex couples. The focus of the law shifted from the mother and father who make the baby to the adults that the state decides are a child's appropriate parents. A lot of people are kind of put off by this phrase natural parent, and I find that it's a useless phrase to talk about natural parenthood when I give a talk. Some people understand that it's a legal term, a term from philosophy, but mostly it sounds offensive, as if you're saying that only biological parents are natural and everything else is unnatural. I prefer to use the phrase instead of natural parent. I refer to biological mothers and fathers, which is what natural parenthood refers to. So just try to understand that the new law in Canada removes references across the board in federal law to biological mothers and fathers relating to all children in Canada, replacing it instead with this term legal parent. Biological mothers and fathers are not created by the law. They existed long before we had law. And the family is an inextricable part of civil society, which I think in order to flourish needs to have some separations from the law. Legal parent, by contrast, is a legal term. It's the state deciding who a child's parents are. For now, most of the time, probably biological mothers and fathers and legal parents will be roughly the same thing. But Canadian law now has an extraordinary power, at least in the law, that it did not used to have, to name who a child's parents are. And I don't know what the consequences will be yet, and I hope that we can discuss that some in our discussion. So for many reasons, I was excited about writing this report with a think tank, two think tanks in Canada, and releasing it in Canada as well as my own country and in Europe and Australia, because there is so much happening here. But I want to tell you about what's happening around the world as well, because this really is a global phenomenon now. It cannot be isolated to any one nation or its borders. Many of you may not know that in Spain, after their recent legalization of same-sex marriage in that country, the National Civil Registry struck the words mother and father from the first document issued to every newborn by the state. Again, not just for children of same-sex couples, but for all newborns. Instead, all birth certificates for children in Spain now read progenitor A and progenitor B instead of mother and father. The concern of many of us who had some concerns about same-sex marriage was that it would make it impolite in polite society to talk about children's need for mothers and fathers. We can only talk about parents instead. I don't think anyone predicted how quickly removal of references to mothers and fathers from the law would follow legalization of same-sex marriage. And if you can't say the word, I'm not sure how you can encourage those people to do the right thing and to stick by their kids whenever possible. But more on that in a moment. A similar proposal was made in Massachusetts after the legalization of same-sex marriage in that state. In that state, the public health department there proposed amending birth certificates for all children in the state to read parent A and parent B instead of mother and father. For now, that recommendation has been tabled by the governor there. It's hard to say what could happen next. In New Zealand and Australia, influential law commissions have broken open the two-person model of parenthood by proposing that children conceived with the use of sperm or egg donors be allowed to have three legal parents. And we're seeing a very similar case evolving in Canada right now. The Globe and Mail reported yesterday the most recent development in the case in Ontario, in which a lesbian couple and the sperm donor father friend of their child are petitioning to have all three of them considered the child's legal parents. The little boy is now 5 years old, and they've been pursuing this case for about 4 years. It sounds good on paper, the idea of having three legal parents. If two parents are good for kids, aren't maybe three are better? And what could be bad for a kid in having multiple loving adults around him or her and committed legally to that child over a lifetime? Most of these proposals, though, have an extraordinarily idealistic view of human relationships and seem to ignore the elephant in the room, which I would say is divorce, and the fact that we've know all too well how difficult it is for two parents to stick together over a childhood to raise their child, much less for a lifetime, to raise their child and for two parents to agree on a child's best interest. And we see nasty custody battles between two parents in so many of our courts. What would happen if we allowed children, for the first time ever, this would be unprecedented around the world, to have three or more legal parents? Because, of course, once you have three legal parents, why not four? Why not five? In fact, in some reproductive technology scenarios, there are five people who could conceivably be called the parents, the commissioning couple, the sperm donor, the egg donor, and the gestational surrogate. When we give multiple adults legal rights as parents over a child, what happens if they can't agree? What happens if they break up? What happens if they fight over custody of the child? What happens if they have an amicable breakup, but we require a child to grow up traveling between three different homes or four different homes or five different homes? What are we going to require children to do in order to satisfy the parenting needs of multiple adults? That would be my question to the judge in this case in Ontario that's developing. That would be my question to these commissions in New Zealand and Australia that have proposed allowing sperm and egg donors to opt in as children's third legal parents. There's also an extraordinary contradiction or troubling issue in the whole matter of biological parents opting in or opting out. The commissions there want biological parents, sperm and egg donors, to opt into parenthood if they wish. Since when do we allow parents to opt in and opt out? And one of the huge contradictions in all this is why when a man conceives a child in a one-night stand, we hold him accountable for child support for 18 years, but a sperm donor is allowed to sign away all legal obligations to a child, even if the mother in question is a single mother. So we've created two different classes of children, some who have rights to the care and protection of two parents, their mother and father, and some who do not. But this is only the beginning. Around the world, we see many steps that governments are taking that signal a greatly heightened level of state intervention and increasing control over reproduction and family life. In Britain, for instance, a recent and I think welcome law banning donor anonymity, it's no longer legal for sperm donors to be anonymous in Britain, egg donors as well, caused a purported drop in the number of persons willing to donate sperm or eggs, especially there's said to be a drastic shortage of sperm now in Britain. Soon thereafter, the government health service in that nation began an active campaign to recruit sperm and egg donors, no longer just allowing the planned conception of children separated from one or both biological parents, but now very intentionally promoting it. In another example of active state support, in high-tax Denmark, the state subsidizes the practice of sperm donation by allowing the income earned by sperm donors to be tax-exempt. The Danish company Cryos, one of the world's largest sperm banks, ships almost three-quarters of its sperm to individuals and couples overseas, all with the implicit support of the Danish taxpayer. And in fact, news articles on this gave rise to a spate of headlines about Viking babies, blue-eyed blonde Viking babies being born all around the world. And in a recent dramatic step, the Danish parliament narrowly passed a law that gives lesbian couples and single women the right to obtain free artificial insemination at publicly funded hospitals. This is not just in the West. In Vietnam, I was just amazed. I just run over these things. I'm mostly doing Google News searches on the web, and there's some other resources as well, which I'll tell you about in a moment. In Vietnam, the state-run hospital is running short of voluntary sperm donors. It is now considering setting up a community sperm bank in which those who request donor sperm must supply a family member or friend who will donate sperm to the bank for use by another couple. One article says that the increasing demand for sperm comes from, quote, families where husband and wife are white-collar workers and from single women who want a baby but wish to be unmarried. So this is not just a Western phenomenon. In Australia, a law passed in the 1980s that allows sperm donors to contact their over age 18 offspring, has now raised the prospect that starting this year, young adults who are conceived using donor sperm might receive a letter from the state alerting them to the sperm donor's wish to contact them. In Australia, as elsewhere, most young people who were conceived with donor sperm were never told the truth by their parents. To help offset the potential shock, the state government in Victoria has proposed a public advertising campaign warning all young adults that they could be contacted by a sperm donor father they never knew about. And I'd like to tell you more about this in our discussion because there's a wrinkle to this as well. Meanwhile, in the United States, the field of reproductive technology continues in an almost entirely unregulated environment. And forgive me, I know more about what's going on in the U.S. than I do in Canada, though some of these trends are similar. Courts all too frequently must decide who a child's parents are, picking and choosing among the many adults who might be involved in planning, conceiving, birthing, and raising a child. In the state of Pennsylvania, a judge recently had to decide parentage in a case in which a surrogate mother carried triplets for a 62-year-old man and his 60-year-old girlfriend. When the couple failed to pick up the infants from the hospital, it was clear from news accounts that they just couldn't wrap their heads around the idea that it really was time to bring the babies home, the babies that had been conceived in a hospital and carried by another woman and then born and were in neonatal intensive care. They weren't planning to bring them home. The hospital initiated steps to put them into foster care. So in response, and eventually with the judge's approval, the surrogate mother took the children home and began raising them as her own. This is a woman on a limited income. She was married. Her husband, they had children. She took these three children home to begin raising them as her own. But the commissioning couple continues to fight for access to the children, and the 62-year-old man has been ordered to pay child support, while the college student who contributed her eggs for their conception asserted her parental rights as well. Recently, in a landmark case in the U.S., the California State Supreme Court heard three cases from lesbian couples who used sperm donors to have children and then split up. In these cases, the non-biological mother figure, none of whom had adopted the child, was either denied access to the child or wished to have no further financial obligations to the child. The courts ruled that in all three cases, the non-biological mother figure is like a child's father and should be granted full parental status and held to the same standard of rights and responsibilities. The outcome has potentially far-reaching implications not just for same-sex couples, but for the many heterosexual couples and stepfamilies, as well as those who might use reproductive technologies or temporarily raise children together without marriage, adoption, or other legal arrangements. We have a huge group of people called step-parents who have been in a quasi-legal status for decades, and there are millions and millions of them. And for now, the new rulings and decisions and proposals regarding same-sex couples are not being extended to step-parents, but they could be, and we don't know how that's going to impact children. In fact, today, same-sex couples, adoptive parents, and singles and infertile couples using donors, third-party donors, now routinely petition to have one or both biological parents left off of the birth certificate, and even to have non-biological parent figures included without going through the process of adoption. Provinces and states can vary in how they issue birth certificates even to various people within their own state. In Quebec, when a woman in a same-sex civil union gives birth, her female partner can be presumed to be the father and can be registered as the father on the child's birth certificate. A similar ruling was recently made in Ontario. Last year in the U.S., a New Jersey judge ruled for the first time in that state that the same-sex partner of a woman who conceives with donor sperm has an automatic right to be listed as a birth parent on the child's certificate without formally having to adopt the child. The state of California allows a second mother to be entered on the birth certificate as the child's father. Earlier this year, Virginia issued a birth certificate to a lesbian adoptive couple that reads Parent 1 and Parent 2 after the couple rejected having one of their names put in the blank for father. A similar suit was just filed in Oregon, and more are likely. In fact, and the whole birth certificate thing is an incredible way into this issue. I was talking just last week with a young woman who's 17, who is herself donor-conceived, has a sperm donor biological father. She went to get her ears pierced recently and had to bring her birth certificate along, and it was the first time she'd looked at it in a number of years, and she realized there's no blank at all for father on her birth certificate. It just says mother, and not even an empty space for father. No father named and no space for father. And she just kind of laughed and said, it took me a while to realize that I wasn't just a clone of my mother. You know, I really do have a father, a biological father. Half of me came from somewhere else. And yet even her birth certificate, I don't know how someone managed to get a birth certificate that doesn't even have a space for a father. So it's just an enormous way into to this topic. And there's a lot that we don't know about what's happening right now. These are just some examples. There are many more, but what I'd like to put on the table is this question. Why should we be concerned about the many rulings, laws, and proposals around the world that are aimed at redefining the two-person mother-father model of parenthood? I argue that a good society protects the interests of its most vulnerable citizens, especially children. Right now, the institution that is most core to children's very survival, that of parenthood, is being fundamentally redefined with the state giving its implicit support and at times leading the way. The common thread running through many of these decisions is the adult right to a child. These claims are undeniably important. The desire for a child is a powerful force felt deep in the soul. It's a desire that must be responded to with respect and compassion. I myself have been blessed with two children. I know what a blessing children are, and I can only imagine the ache one feels when one, for whatever reason, cannot have children. The claim that medicine and society should help those who cannot, for whatever reason, bear children is certainly a legitimate claim. But the rights and needs of adults who wish to bear children are not the only part of the story. Children, too, have rights and needs. For example, the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, ratified in 1989, signed by every nation in the world except for my own, the U.S., and Somalia. So it is signed by yours, and so you can, in Canada, states that the child shall have the right from birth to a name, the right to acquire a nationality, and as far as possible, the right to know and be cared for by his or her parents. Debates at the time of the ratification make clear that the drafters intended his or her parents to mean biological mothers and fathers. And in fact, the idea of the right to know your parents wouldn't mean much if we're not talking about biological mothers and fathers. The authors of this convention understood several key features necessary to human identity, security, and flourishing, having a name, being a citizen of a nation whose laws protect you, and whenever possible, being raised by the two people whose physical union made you. Adults who support the use of new technologies to bear children sometimes say that biology doesn't matter, that all children need is a loving family. Yet, in an ironic contradiction, biology clearly matters to the adults who sometimes go to extreme lengths, undergoing high-risk medical procedures, buying eggs, sperm, or renting wombs from strangers, and paying quite a lot of money to create a child genetically related to at least one of them. In a striking contradiction, these same people will often insist that the child's biological relationship to an absent donor father or mother should not really matter to the child. Now, of course, there is a very real and urgent role for the state to play in defining parenthood. Some biological parents, as we know, all too tragically, present a danger to their children or are otherwise unable to raise their children and recognize that another set of parents would be better for their child. Adoption is a pro-child social institution, one that I'm absolutely for. I cannot emphasize enough how much I support adoption. An institution that finds parents for children who need them. It's an admirable expression of altruistic love, a kind of love that transcends our hardwired tendencies to protect our blood relations among all others. But the existence of legal adoption was never intended to support the idea that children don't care who their mothers and fathers are, or to justify the planned separation of children from biological mothers and fathers before the children are even conceived. Certainly, biology is not everything. It does not and should not determine the full extent or depth of human relationships. But the actions and testimony of children and adults, as well as a great deal of social science evidence, powerfully suggest that biology does matter. It's not everything, but it does matter. To be perfectly clear, my question is not whether children love the parents who raised them. Children almost universally and unquestioningly love their parents, whether their parents are married, divorced, single, gay, straight, whatever. Rather, the question is how children feel and how they make sense of their identities when their mother or father or both, for whatever reason, is absent from their daily lives. The first generation of donor-conceived children who are now coming of age are telling remarkable stories that challenge, I think, some of our current reigning assumptions about parenthood. Most of this first generation of young people were conceived by married heterosexual couples using donor sperm. This is something that heterosexuals were doing long before same-sex couples came up with it. Anecdotally, many of these young people are now speaking out about the powerful impact on children's identity when adults purposefully conceive a child with a clear intention of separating that child from a biological parent, often a father, sometimes a mother. These young people often say they were denied the birthright of being raised by, or at least, at the very least, knowing about their biological fathers or mothers, and they say that this intentional denial profoundly shapes their quest to understand who they are. These young people are forming organizations and being quoted in news articles around the world, and they're using the internet to seek contact with their sperm donors and to find their half-siblings conceived with the same sperm. They hail from the United States, Canada, Australia, Britain, Japan, the Netherlands, and elsewhere. Numbers are hard to come by, but estimates are that in the United States, at least, the number of children born each year through artificial insemination range from 30 to 70,000, and that about 3,000 each year are conceived using donor eggs. And I've heard estimates that there are perhaps about a million donor-conceived young people in the world today, but all these numbers are fuzzy, largely because in many of our nations, such as Canada and the U.S., it's almost entirely unregulated, so we just don't know what's happening in clinics and what's resulting in pregnancies, and no one's counting. While the numbers arguably are small, they are growing, and the stories these young people tell raise questions not only about their own experience, which should be examined in its own right, but also about the prospects for the next generation of children who could well be born from technologies on the horizon that I'll tell you about in a moment. Donor-conceived young people point out that the informed consent of the most vulnerable party, the child, is not obtained in reproductive technology procedures that intentionally separate children from one or both biological parents. Some of them ask how the state can aid and defend a practice that denies them the right to know and be raised by their parents, or at least to know their own genetic history, a right that everyone else is, except adopted children, and we can talk about that if you'd like, is guaranteed, and adoptees are increasingly getting access to that information. But there are some separate debates there. Some of the donor-conceived young people quoted in news articles refer to themselves as lopsided or half-adopted. At least one uses the term kinship slave. Margot Somerville has termed them genetic orphans. I'm not sure if they accept that term or not. Some born of lesbian or gay parents call themselves queer spawn, although others in the same situation find that term offensive. No studies have been done yet on these young people's long-term emotional experience. What studies we have are about 2- and 3-year-olds who, not surprisingly, don't look that different from other 2- and 3-year-olds. Clearly, rigorous long-term studies need to be done. For now, we should listen to their compelling voices. I'd like to share a few of those voices with you, but I also want to emphasize that these young people are diverse. They're emerging from all around the world. They're in their teens, 20s, 30s, some conceived of donor sperm or in their 50s, and they do not speak with one voice. They have similar concerns, but their experiences vary and their concerns vary. So I'm not trying to represent them as one voice or to say that I can speak for them. I can't. In interviews, donor-conceived young adults often say something like this: my sperm donor is half of who I am. One young woman says she wants to meet her donor because she wants to know what half of me is, where half of me comes from. Another says, I want to meet the donor because I want to know the other half of where I'm from. Another is seeking information because she says, I feel my right to know who I am and where I come from has been taken away from me. And in one news article, a 17-year-old in Texas said that she plans to ask the California sperm bank that aided in her conception to forward a letter to her donor when she turns 18. There's a lot of unanswered questions in my life, she said, and I guess I just want the answers. By contrast, her mother, interviewed for the same story, said, as a woman dealing with the prospect of infertility, all you want is that baby. It never even occurred to me this child might want to find her biological father someday.